Okay, hi, I'm Todd Cranin with the Reason Podcast, and I'm here with Johan Norberg, and he's here talking about his new film, or television show, I guess I should say, an hour-long documentary called Sweden, Lessons for America. And tell me if I'm right about this, Johan. It's like the Sweden you thought you knew isn't so exactly, right? It's like many people nowadays are recommending Sweden as a possible model for the United States. And your answer to that is, yes, it is, but not for the reasons you think. Is that a good summary of your theme?
Yes, I think that's exactly it. I think what started this whole project is, well, basically two things. One of them being that whatever I do, whatever my show is on, one of the first questions from the audience is always, so tell me more about Sweden, your home country. So, okay, at some point I'm going to have to talk about that. But the other thing was, the other source of inspiration was, you know, the Bernie Sanders of the world, who always talk about how their countries should be more like Sweden. And then they have a very vague idea about what really Sweden is all about. And when they do have strong opinions, it's stuck in the 1970s, and it's a very old image of Sweden. So then I thought I'd better update them.
Yeah, you get that across really nicely in the beginning of the film. You go right to, not Sweden, it actually starts in Times Square, right? The heart of New York City. And you start asking Americans off the street, what do you think of Sweden? And it's great because they'd rattle off a list of cliches, which is kind of what I would expect from my compatriots, right? What does Sweden mean to you? And you hear IKEA, ABBA, Swedish meatballs, I don't know what else.
Yeah, socialism.
And socialism, right? That's the last one. Socialism, and you just sort of hold on his expression, right? And his expression is, I can't tell if he likes it or he hates it, but maybe he's like, I have strong feelings about this, but I'm going to keep my composure for the cameras. I sympathize with that. Like, I kind of get that. Having grown up in the Cold War myself in the 80s, I was taught exactly what you just show in the film. There was Soviet communism, which was one extreme. There was the United States, which was thought of as the extreme of capitalism. And Sweden had found the third way, the magical way right in between, and was happy and wonderful. And that's not your message here.
No, the interesting thing is that popular perception of Sweden, it's stuck in 1975 for some reason. And we've had many different eras where policies and economics it's been in all places, all kinds of places. For 20 years or 25 years, in the late 1960s till the early 1990s, Sweden was this middle way between capitalism and communism, when social democrats were always in power and they just expanded the government and taxed the hell out of everybody. So that was true for a brief interlude of Swedish history. But for some reason, this is stuck in the perception of everyone when it comes to Sweden. So that's why this story starts 100 years earlier, the documentary. It talks about what made Sweden rich, what turned Sweden into one of the most admired social and economic models in the world, because that was something completely different. That was an era of laissez-faire economics, small government, and incredibly rapid growth, innovative companies, turning Sweden into one of the richest countries on the planet much a long time before we had the big government, high taxes, and so on.
So I don't want to do a whole summary of Swedish history, which you actually do pretty succinctly in the documentary, but the gist of it is Sweden was poor, then things got wealthier over the from like 1850 to 1950, and then comes this other sort of era, so a relatively brief interlude in the history of Sweden.
And that was a moment in time when we were already one of the richest countries on the planet, and that was when taxes were lower than in the United States in Sweden. And we also had other cultural preconditions, sort of. We led the world when it came to trust, when it came to work ethic, when it came to declining public benefits, even if we were deserved it according to the rules. And so then the Social Democrats, but also sort of the center-right party said, we've got all this. Now let's start redistributing it. Now we can do whatever we like because we're on top of the world. And then in just 20 years, they doubled the size of government, public spending from 30 to 60%. They regulated the labor market, and they kept on doing that until that collapsed in a terrible economic crisis.
Yeah, as you say, from the rooftop in a rooftop in Stockholm, we screwed up. Or what do you say? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, so I'm standing on a rooftop to make it seem dramatic, so that I'm always close to the edge and talking about all the great things that Sweden had accomplished by 1970. And guess what happened next? We screwed it up.
Yeah.
And that's what we did. That's when we began to see how some of these wealth foundations were being eroded by these policies, how entrepreneurs left Sweden, how real wages stopped climbing, how Sweden went from being the fourth richest country on the planet to the 13th richest country on a GDP per capita basis. And it all ended in this financial crisis in the early 1990s, when the central bank for a while had an interest rate at 500% to desperately try to defend the Swedish currency.
So if things were going well for, you know, 100 years or so, what was the impetus behind that? What was the idea that, say, we need to radically restructure society in a sort of cradle to grave welfare state?
I think it's the traditional attitude that, you know, he that has satisfied his thirst turns his back to the well, in a way. We took it for granted. We took all this wealth for granted. We were much richer than the others. Sweden had stayed out of two world wars as well. So we had everything, and we thought that we could accomplish anything. So why should we bother with the things that are bad in society? There were still problems, still at least relative poverty. Why don't we get everybody, everything, immediately? And I think that's the general impetus in most countries. When you've created that wealth, you also want to give everybody a share of it. And then you tend to forget some of these preconditions, the foundations of that wealth, which were economical, but also, I think, some cultural attitudes that really made Sweden successful, and also made, in a way, the welfare state more successful in Sweden than it would have been in other places. Like our levels of trust, like our work ethic and things like that. That was being eroded by this growth in government as well.
So describe what that interim, I shouldn't call it an interim period, but a good 20, 25-year period from, what, about 1970 to 1990?
Something like that.
What were that like? What were you go through some of the policies in the film, and they are fascinating. You see what a third way country would look like, and it is very different from anything that I would have imagined.
Yeah. Well, what happened was that, first of all, they ratcheted up taxes in all sorts of way, more indirect hidden taxes, income taxes, and payroll taxes, so that people wouldn't know how much they paid, basically. Spending, public spending on all levels increased from 30% to 60%. So they basically began to socialize all those services, social services that had been done by businesses and associations and on a family basis, like child care, like health care, elderly care. Those things were now being socialized in many ways. And at the same time, they were regulating the labor market dramatically and taking many of the decisions away from workers and employers, and instead handing them to politicians.
The big policy that you really spend a lot of time on, that I think is the most sort of radical restructuring of society during that period, was where, explains to me if I'm wrong, but workers received a large part of the profits of businesses and were sort of encouraged to take over the business over time. Explain that. I'm not doing a very good job.
Yeah, no. Neither did the socialists when they explained the policies.
All right, I'm in good company.
You sound very much like the Social Democratic Minister of Finance at that time.
But it's well-intentioned. So,
exactly. They wanted, this was a way to socialize Swedish businesses, because at some points in history, I mean, social democrats in Sweden have been largely pragmatic. But when the tide of ideas has turned too far in a socialist direction, they've tried to socialize businesses. They tried that in the 40s and failed. They tried it in the 70s as well. And then this was an idea that came from the trade unions. They call it the Wage Earners Fund, which sounds much better than socialization and government taking over your business. And the idea was to tax big businesses at an extortionary rate and use those resources to get trade unions and the government to buy into those companies. So it was a way to really, well, hang the capitalists with their own rope, so to speak. And this was an idea that I mean, the Social Democrats didn't believe in this. We've learned that now when they've written their biographies, their memoirs, and we've heard what they said. They said privately, this is awful. This is going to ruin Sweden. This is going to ruin what we've always done, this kind of pragmatic attitude with yes, trying to socialize from the consumption side with high taxes, but always leave big businesses on their own to compete fiercely and constantly create the benefits that we need. Even the Prime Minister, Olaf Palme, he hated this idea privately, but publicly he was very much in favor of it because the grassroots were, the socialists, the radical fringe of the trade unions loved this. And then that's what they had to fight for. But this was, apart from those groups, it was incredibly unpopular in Sweden, because this was seen as the way to turn Sweden into a Soviet state, basically. So much of the opposition to big government in Sweden was really a reaction to this attempt to socialize. And we even had in the early 1980s a demonstration through the streets of Stockholm with 100,000 people, which is pretty big in a country back then, like 6 million inhabitants. And sort of business owners, small businesses, big businesses, the middle class, everybody on the street just saying, we don't want your socialism. And this began to turn the tide.
That is so bizarre. I can't even begin to tell you. It is a capitalist strike.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? It's like very, a bad Ayn Rand novel.
It's very Randian, yeah.
Okay. That's kind of fascinating. So I feel like there are some echoes of history here because, as you know, or as you may know, recent news here in the United States, a politician, Elizabeth Warren, came up with a very similar proposal, maybe minus the extortionary taxation, but that a proposal that, you know, companies over $1 billion, their boards, their governing board should be stocked with, 40% of the workers. It should be composed 40% of all the workers. Is that a similar kind of proposal? Is that along the lines of what happened in Sweden?
That's more like what did happen in Sweden, rather than the trade unions and the government taking over Swedish businesses. It's more like the trade unions got more of representation on the boards, and they also got more of a say in policy generally. The blue-collar trade unions have always been very close to the Social Democrats in Sweden. But here's something that's interesting, I think, when we talk about differences between Sweden and the United States, and especially the sort of the social democratic side of Sweden and the United States. Because one idea of the Social Democrats, and now I'm talking about the pragmatic pro-business Social Democrats who wanted a welfare state, but they knew that we needed businesses to make it happen, was that they were in favor, most of the time, of creative destruction. They wanted to basically run the old businesses to the ground if they were inefficient and smooth the transition over to new businesses. They were always in favor, even during the crazy years, they were in favor of free trade because they wanted competition, because they knew that the only way to fund a welfare state was to constantly produce in a more productive way. So actually, this way of getting trade union representatives on the board of Swedish companies and involving them in much of the decision making, that was often a way to align the interests of businesses with trade unions so that trade unions would be in agreement with this creative destruction. So quite often what happens in Swedish businesses is that the owners or the directors and the trade unions explain, now we're going to have to downsize in agreement, because that's the only way to make us more productive in the future. We have to restrain the wage increases because that's the only way to make us internationally competitive. Now, when I hear these things from Elizabeth Warren and others, it seems like their idea is that we should get the trade unions in there to block much of this creative destruction, much of this constant restructuring of the economy. And in that way, it's just a way to sort of grind the system to a halt.
Yeah, to emphasize and to show the labor and management solidarity that Sweden has. You in the film, you actually do a sort of Stockholm dirty jobs, right? Yeah. You sort of get your hard hat on and you patrol the sewers, as it were.
That's right.
It's kind of fun to talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, it was quite interesting, and we're removing sort of the oil and fat from restaurants, so it's quite a dirty job, literally, even though you can't smell it when you watch it. But the interesting thing is the garbage collector that I'm driving around with, because he's this kind of enormous heavy metal socialist kind of trade union guy. And the things he says about the business he's in, I think it's not the thing that you would hear from most trade unions in the US. It's like, yeah, what's most important to me is the prosperity of this company, to make it prosper so that it can create more jobs and decent wages and so on. So he's very much like the cliche of Swedish consensus-oriented economic culture in a way.
So that period, that 20, 25 years, was always described to me as Sweden had found utopia. They'd found the paradise, and they were the model from which we should all follow. But you describe it as a real failure, and something happened, right? Things seemed to get worse. They got better, and then they got worse very quickly. And by the late 80s, things were really looking bad in Sweden. Yeah. What happened? What had come to a crisis?
Yeah. Well, first of all, it was a crisis of productivity in Sweden. We began to lag behind all the other industrialized countries. We thought we were always going to grow faster than everybody else, but suddenly they were all catching up with us. And suddenly we were lagging behind, and we didn't create the new jobs. And the crazy thing is that we had half a century where we didn't create a single net job in the private sector. All new jobs were created in the public sector. And then eventually, I mean, even the socialists understood this is not going to work in the long run. Who's going to pay for all of this? So this was something that crept up on us in a way. But the other thing that began to happen was also you saw this erosion of some of the traditional attitudes of consensus, the work ethic, the trust in your fellow being. The government, as it distorted some of the incentives by increasing taxes on education, risk-taking, all those things, and at the same time increasing public benefits, it made it difficult to get people to do what they should do in a healthy economy. So the government became more authoritarian in many ways. It became more aggressive in getting the taxes and more aggressive in pushing people to the right sectors in the economy. And I think that the public perception of things going wrong in Sweden was not so much about the GDP per capita beginning to drop. It was more like a few very public incidents of this aggressive, more authoritarian Swedish way in the 1970s. And one of them involves our greatest film director, Ingmar Bergman, who was suddenly taken by police during rehearsals at the Royal Theatre because he was suspected of tax evasion. And, I mean, he had a nervous breakdown and left Sweden for good. We had Astrid Lindgren, the most popular writer of children's books, including Pippi Longstocking, who was taxed at a marginal tax rate of 102% and wrote this story about this, an essay about how all the witches and monsters that she created were not at all as vicious as the Swedish tax authorities. This and how people, entrepreneurs, actors, sports stars, they all left Sweden in the 1970s to escape from this. And I think this created the conviction among people that something is going wrong here.
So in Ingmar Bergman's autobiography, The Magic Lantern, which I highly recommend, he paints this portrait of Sweden that I talked about earlier as a paradise. And he's a big star and he gets to make all the movies that he wants in the ways that he wants to make them. And he's a celebrated director and writer. And then all of a sudden, he gets a knock on the door from the Swedish authorities. And like a Kafka-esque nightmare, or like even a Bergmanian nightmare, everything turns to dust very quickly. And he spends, I don't know, 20, 30 pages in his autobiography talking about what this nightmare looked like, of being hounded by the authorities and the police to the very end. And as you know, he had a nervous breakdown and he spent some time in a sanitarium. And it's absolutely terrifying. And I'm wondering, that wasn't the intention of where this was all going, was it?
Yeah, no. It was. This was the way to create the utopia of harmony, and everybody should be kind, and we shouldn't have to deal with all these awful things of economic incentives to make people work hard. But then when we remove those incentives, you have to get people to do the right thing in another way. And then it became a more authoritarian government. And I think this thing, for a long time, Ingmar Bergman had it good in Sweden. Just like big businesses in Sweden had it quite good. And not just because Sweden generally is nice, but also because the big ones, the great stars, they had always favorable treatment historically. Just as much as the socialists sort of taxed small businesses heavily, they gave exceptions to big businesses, to family-owned companies, to experts and things like that, because we knew they needed those exceptions to make the economy work. But then at some point, they had to set an example to show that no one gets away.
Yeah, he did get away, right? He was actually a good... He called himself a good, proper social democrat, like everyone else at the time. And then he went into exile for a long time, and he started making these really like anti-authoritarian films from Munich in Germany. They weren't always his best films, but it was interesting, really interesting to see the turn that he took ideologically.
Yeah, and that has been credited in the loss of the Social Democrats in the elections of 1976. The first time since 1932, actually, that the socialists were out of power in Sweden. For 44 years, they governed. But then when sort of even Astrid Lindgren and Ingmar Bergman, when they even got them, they could do anything. So they just thought, the people thought that, let's get them out.
So 1990, 91, comes around. There is a big reform that changes the whole political and economic scene in Sweden. What happens? What's the result of that?
Yeah, because we have this, and we covered that, how slowly but steadily we lost ground to other countries. But then everything exploded in 1991. That's the big financial crisis. It was a debt and inflation-fueled boom that just collapsed. And at that point, sort of the social democratic finance minister, he basically said, okay, many of our policies were absurd. Our tax system is perverse. This is not working anymore. So then in wide agreement, basically all political parties but the communists said that we have to dismantle this whole mess that we've created for ourselves. And then largely in consensus, what happened was that we began to reduce taxes quite substantially in Sweden, reduce public spending by a third, began to privatize businesses and opening up for private providers in the welfare state, like in healthcare, a national school voucher system to introduce innovation in the education system, and a pension reform where we made it sustainable for the future by turning it into a defined contributions rather than a defined benefits system, and partially privatized it as well. So it was very dramatic at the time. And if you compare it internationally, I think Sweden moved further away from what we had done than other European countries. And if you look at economic freedom of the world statistics, things like that, Sweden was liberalized faster than countries like the US under Reagan.
So there's a voucher, school voucher system there.
Yeah.
And you went back to your old school there to see what had changed. And the answer is, I guess, nothing, or it looked a little nicer, maybe?
It was a little nicer.
And your hair is nicer, too, I'll say that. There's
Thank
a big
you.
Portion of this film that centers on Johan's hair. And this is very important because it's clearly a personal statement. And the hair, just like the social welfare state has been reduced and cut back, your hair, likewise, has been reduced.
Right,
and cut
but
back.
I removed more than a third.
That is true.
I had this kind of, goth Robert Smith style hair. At that time, I was, I was a young anarchist. Now I'm more sort of a decent classical liberal, and
congratulations.
My hair has changed with it. Yeah.
Very good. So there's vouchers in schools. There are so the state provides sort of finances.
Yeah, that's right.
But so moving on to healthcare for a second, the state finances healthcare, but the actual providers are private. Is that what?
Yeah, that's correct? Quite often what the system is like. in the schools, the private schools get exactly the same funding as the public ones. When it comes to healthcare, often sort of primary, the first ones you meet, they are private providers quite often. And they also then get the same kind of funding as the public ones. Then when it comes to hospitals, we've privatized a big hospital in Stockholm, but most of the big hospitals are publicly owned. But it's funded by the government, but on a regional level. And that might be we don't care that much about those differences in Sweden, but since everybody in the US talks about a single payer system and assumes that Sweden has it, it's important to point that out. It's not the federal government. I mean, it's not the national government organizing healthcare. It's the regions in Sweden, and most of it is paid for by their local taxes, and that's even a flat tax. It's not sort of the progressive income tax.
Interesting. So on this issue of taxation, too, it's interesting. After post-1990, 1991, Sweden has a lower corporate tax than the United States.
Yeah.
But also, you make a point of this in the film, the poor and the working class pay very high taxes as well. It's not just the middle and upper classes.
That
seems wrong somehow. What's going on there?
Yeah, it seems wrong, but perhaps that's the only way we can fund a big government, because it's still fairly big in Sweden. I mean, it's public spending at around 49% of GDP. And if you are to fund that by taxing the rich, by taxing big businesses, they do what they did in the 1970s. They dodge, and they have tax lawyers, and they move to Monaco. So what the Social Democrats understood was that we have to look to the most loyal taxpayers. That's the poor. That's the middle classes. So we've got sort of the basic, the most important income tax. It's a flat 30% local tax, around 30%. But more than that, it's also, I mean, we've got a VAT, a value-added tax on all consumption at 25%. And that's a regressive tax where the poor pay exactly the same amount as the rich. So the dirty little secret is that we don't squeeze the rich, we squeeze the poor in Sweden. And even, as I mentioned before, even some specific exceptions to the richest, to the most important ones for Swedish wealth. And I do remember when the socialists introduced a special tax exemption for people who owned their own businesses privately, and they just wanted to keep them in Sweden. And they exempted them from the taxes that others had to pay. And this social democrat said, yeah, it's unfair. We don't like it, but we have no other solution. And that's what I think that leftists in the US has to learn, that the Swedish Social Democrats understood. You can have a big government, or you can make the rich pay for it all. You have to pick one. You can't have both.
Yeah, one thing that goes through my head when I'm watching the film, and I'm sure this goes through the minds of a lot of Americans when they see it, is how does Sweden pull this off? A lot of these programs and a lot of these schemes, just I get the very strong sense they would not fly in the United States. And I say that as someone who went to troubled public schools in New York City that did not suffer from any lack of funding. And then you eventually get to the point of this idea of social trust in Sweden. That's clearly a key to success. Why do you have it? Why do we lack it?
Yeah. Well,
and can we turn that around?
Yeah. Why you don't have it, I do not know. I'll have to think about that. But why do we have it? Well, some would like to say, and some socialists have said, that this is because of the welfare state. We've created such a nice government that takes care of everybody and cares, provides for everybody. So that creates trust. There's a problem with that idea. And that problem is that Scandinavians generally lead the world in trust. But if you look at people of Scandinavian ancestry in the United States, they also lead the world in trust and are much more likely to say that you can trust most people. And they are even more trusting than Swedes left back in Sweden. So, and most of these people and their ancestors then, they moved here 100 and 150 years ago, 100 years before we had a welfare state in Sweden. So there must be something else. And I would think it's related to a fairly harmonious history. In Sweden and Norway, we never had feudalism, so no landlord telling everybody what to do, and you have to sort of hide your talents from him to...
What did you have instead of feudalism?
We had property-owning farmers, small farmers who owned their own land.
Good deal.
And that's how you create work ethic, because they knew that they had to work hard to get anything, and if they worked hard, they could get the results and reap the rewards. But it's also a way to make sure that all the relations are based on, it comes on a voluntary basis. And we had that for hundreds of years when everybody else had aristocracy, landlords, and also foreign invaders and conflict, whereas we in Nordic countries, most of the time, it was fairly peaceful, little conflict, few sort of foreign occupiers whom we distrusted. And this makes for, and furthermore, we're all related basically in Sweden. Everybody's sort of the second cousin of everybody else. And that kind of brings forth this attitude that everybody that I see, they are a little bit like me, not that different, and I can probably trust them. And if they end up in government, there's this social pressure that they shouldn't benefit from this themselves. They should just try to be decent. And combine that then with a history of transparency, of openness in the public affairs, because of what classical liberals did in the 18th century, which makes sure that everything is public, what the government do, even their sort of internal documents, basically. And this means that we always had a foundation of saying that, look, we can trust others, so it's easy to start businesses and trade with one another, invest in somebody else's venture and so on. But also, probably, it's easier to build a welfare state than it is if you don't have this. If you are going to be willing to hand money over to politicians to give to somebody else, you'd better expect those politicians not to be corrupt and steal it themselves. And you should expect those who get the money to really deserve it. If you don't have that, if you live in a country where you have more corruption, where people are just going to take anything that they can lay their hands on, a welfare state wouldn't create trust. It would probably just result in collapse.
And that social trust leads me to another part of your film that really filled me with envy, frankly, as a citizen. The place where you say that Sweden was really able to have adult conversations, right, about politics and solutions and economics and that sort of thing, something that America chronically is unable to do, especially lately. You might argue we elected a troll to the highest office in the land, and that we are just filled with sort of name-calling and partisan sniping at each other all the time from every end of the spectrum. Is that really what lies underneath your ability to have adult conversations? Is it that social trust that's the foundation for those kinds of conversations?
I think that's part of it because, when we reformed our pension system in Sweden, and every country everywhere has experienced that this is impossible, because everybody thinks that what they hear is that they are going to take my pensions away from me. But when Swedes heard then from the left and from the right that they just said, okay, we built an unsustainable system, it's not going to work, so we're going to have to reduce what you get, then, I wouldn't say that all Swedes are happy with it. They disliked it, obviously, but they thought that, okay, we made a mistake, probably most of them. These politicians aren't at least lying to me. They aren't deceiving me. If you have that level of trust, you at least think that there's some point to this. It is unsustainable. We're going to have to reform it. So I think trust is part of that kind of adult conversation. But it's also generally a consensus-oriented culture. We're a little bit afraid of conflicts. And we've always, partly perhaps because of just being fairly homogenous, this population, we sort of shift opinion simultaneously with everybody else in Sweden. So we go further in a particular direction than others because there are fewer blocks, fewer loudmouth critics of the system and so on. But then when you begin to change, then everybody sort of falls into line and do the same thing as well. So I'm not sure if we can say that it's just sort of an adult conversation about these things. It might also be that we're just socially a bit awkward, and we don't want to make a fuss, even if we dislike what's being decided from above.
So you talk about consensus and that you like consensus, but as we speak, right, we're looking at a recent election in Sweden, and what the far-right party now owns, what, 20% of the
almost
vote?
Almost 18%.
Almost 18% of the vote. That doesn't sound like consensus to me. that sounds like that Sweden is being swept up in the same trends that seems to be sweeping a lot of the Western world.
Yeah. Yeah, and this is what makes everybody so confused, because when I say that we've got a consensus-oriented history in Sweden, and then they watch the election result, and yes, we've got this far-right populist party, which is not like sort of traditional populists in Europe. They are much more radical, at least their history. Quite recently, they came from the neo-Nazi movement in Sweden. And also, they make it difficult to form a government because we've got two opposing blocs, the center-right bloc that has been in government for 4 years now, and the center-right opposition. And they don't want to cooperate, not with the Sweden Democrats, but not with one another either. And people say, well, you like consensus, don't you? Well, nah, we do, but we also have this, we know where we fit in, and we would never see a grand coalition of sort of German style in Sweden, because we've got a tradition of, on this side, we organize everybody of these opinions, and on that side, you organize everybody of that opinion, or historically of that social class. And that makes it incredibly difficult to cooperate across the aisle. So, Sweden is a bit more normal, perhaps you can say, perhaps a bit too normal nowadays to this extent. And the larger story is, I don't think, one about populism and immigration issues. It's more about fragmentation. It's about these blocs and parties that used to be able to organize everybody if they were blue collar or if they were in the professions or something like that. That's not the case anymore. They can't, because it's a more pluralist society. People have different educations and ideas and identities. We do not have this sense that everybody is your second cousin anymore. Immigration is part of that, but so is culture, so is the remote control, so is internet, so is the modern world. It makes us able to be more in line with our own sort of inner life and identity, rather than just sort of going into these neatly contained boxes wherever they are. And that, I think, generally is a good thing, but it makes it very difficult for the old structures and institutions and parties that used to think that we were almost all alike and we could just be told what to do in the long run. And this provides a big problem in the future for this for a history of where we've been used to this consensus solution-oriented perception. Because now it's not enough anymore that the Social Democrats tell their voters that this is the case in the future, let's do this. Because they go, why? You haven't earned that sort of right to speak in our name anymore. And this is a major challenge.
Immigration is also a major challenge, right? If a culture is largely, a lot of the success of the political culture is based on everyone is like me, the integration of immigrants seems to be a bit of a challenge. And maybe that's an area, I think, where you didn't actually go into this in the film, but it seems like that is an area where maybe Sweden could actually learn a lesson from the United States.
Yeah, exactly. Because many of the systems that we've built, and not just these sort of parties and institutions traditionally, but also many of the policies on the labor market or how our welfare benefits are organized and things like that, they are all based on this idea of a homogenous population. Well, it's really a one-size-fits-all perspective on all these things. And we're supposed to have the same kind of education, language skills, and the same kind of experiences and so on. When that's not the case anymore, people do not fit into this thing. And that's problematic. We're becoming a country of immigrants now.
You've accepted more refugees as a percentage of the population than I think any European country.
Quite right. In 2015, we had 160,000 asylum seekers. And in a country of 10 million inhabitants, that's quite a lot. but also for several decades, we've been quite open compared to other countries. And I mean, I'm in favor of that. But the problem is that we have an internal domestic border as well around our society, around the labor market. We don't have government-mandated minimum wages, but we do have very high de facto minimum wages because of collective bargaining, because of the trade unions. And that makes entry-level jobs easy to get if you have high education, if you've got great Swedish language skills. But if you are from Somalia, or if you're from Syria, and you haven't even finished second-level education, then you won't ever get that first job. And you need the first job to get the second, the third. You need it to enter society and learn the language and so on. So I think what immigration does is it exposes some of the weaknesses that were always there in this kind of statist system where one size was supposed to fit everybody. We've already seen that in a younger generation as well that doesn't fit into these things. But immigration puts that sort of a spotlight on those problems.
Now, the most important question of all is, when and where can we see Sweden Lessons for America?
Right. I think already in late September, September 21, I think it's going to be airing on online, Free to Choose's website. And if you just Google Sweden Lessons for America, you'll find it there. But then on public television in October, it will air. People are going to have to check their local listing because, unlike Sweden, it's not in one channel at the same time for everybody, which would have made life easier for us all. But it varies depending on state and city. But mostly, I think there's a focus on late October.
Excellent. Johan Norberg, thanks for talking all things Sweden for us.
Thank you very much.
I'm Todd Cranin, and this is The Reason Podcast.